Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.
Thank you for coming back to the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. I am Terry Foy, and you are listening to this on hopefully the last day of August, which means that once again, we are still talking about recruiting, and this time we're doing it with Johns Hopkins head coach Pete Milliman. Coach Milliman, how does recruiting work? Thank you for joining.
That's the first question, huh?
Yeah.
Thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to the conversation. So
the actual first question is the same for everybody, and it's how do you describe yourself as an evaluator?
Okay, that's the first question, huh? I would like to say as thorough and accurate as possible. I would also admit probably a bit unique. I mean, everybody has their own eye. Everybody has their own style. You're going to be attracted to players that you see in your environment. So when you're watching them on the field, when they start doing like things, that's you know, something that can jump to you that doesn't jump the same way to other people. But you know, the attraction to athleticism and size and speed and things like that are probably going to be common other places. But when, you know, you run offenses that, you know, initiate with pick play behind and stuff on wings, up top, alley dodges, sweeps, things like that. A lot of change directions, long dodges. There's a lot of different ways you can do that. And that's on an offensive side. You know, defensively, you know, you got off ball, you know, awareness and on ball ability, and, you know, stick heavy feet, V hold, cross hand, all that kind of stuff. So when you see those things, like a lot of times they translate to you a little bit quicker, but I don't know how I would answer describing myself as an evaluator. I try to be as thorough and accurate as possible, but you know, it's an art as much as a science, I think, a lot of times.
So there was a lot there that we're going to get into, but I was really excited about the opportunity for this conversation because I think it carries with it an internal tension that makes any conversation good. So, you know, having known you for at this point, I don't know, more than a decade, one of the things to your point about describing yourself as a little unique in how you evaluate that I felt like I was able to latch on to early is that you were pretty, I don't want to say dogmatic, but I don't have a better word for it. You had a firmness in your point of view. And it was simple, and we'll get into that. But I also think that it has evolved recently based on some of the comments that you've shared with me. And so I want to get into that as well. But let's start with the firmness and a point of view. The thing that I enjoyed the most about it was that it was simple. Like, and this isn't limited to recruiting. This is kind of your general ethos for the sport was like, throw the ball to the open guy. Like when I think about what Pete Milliman cares about, that's what it is. It is throw the ball to the open guy. And it's not limited to offensive players too. It's in the clear and a lot of other aspects of the game. So just can you speak to that in general in terms of, you know, whether it's Jeff Teat or Matt Collison, the throw the ball to the open guy-ness of what has mattered for how you have approached just choosing the players that you like.
Sure, and I'll probably try and steer this away from offense as much as possible. Although it's always going to tend to flow back that way when you're, you know, asking offensive oriented questions or talking to somebody who's, you know, offensively oriented as a background. But you know, as a head coach, I think there's themes for your team and the way you want to play and the way you want to move from one end of the field to the other and the way you want to execute in half field scenarios. And you know, you bring up a phrase that it's probably often said around here and probably always has been in my career, even to go back to Pfeiffer and before that. But there's an element of team offense. There's an element of team lacrosse that has to be coordinated amongst the players, not just singularly who can do what, but how can we do this together? And there's a lot of times overcomplication of things because they're trying to run this or trying to run that. But at the end of the day, if there's somebody standing wide open and he can score, or if he's, you know, over the midline, you can get him up the ball in the clear, or, you know, you pick up a ground ball behind your own net and you need to get it all the way to the other end of the field. Like, stop looking, you know, so big and so far. Just look for the first open play, first open pass, the first open player, and just trust that process to accumulate and stack. And so, I love that as an idea, and I love that as a team concept. I think I heard this a long time ago, that pass the ball is a way of passing trust and sharing the responsibility onto the next player. You know, I am not overvaluing my own opinion as the ball carrier, in that I will make the right decision or the perfect one. I'll trust that by getting you the ball, you will then make the next right decision, even if that's getting it back to me. And I think those are great idealistic, you know, concepts. You gotta teach them, and you gotta break through some barriers and how guys see the field and how guys think. That concept overall, I think, carries throughout the way you play. If there's an open guy on the field, I don't know if there's another evaluation that needs to be made. Like, he's open, and if he's not the most open player, you trust that he's gonna move that ball onto the next open player.
And the reason I wanted to start there is because, and you know, the way that your career has developed is that you've kind of moved on. It really does require 6 or 7 years to see a full cycle from, you know, the players whose commitments you took through the end of their college career. And so, you know, really isolate that Cornell 22 team where you were heavily involved in recruiting pretty much everybody. And one of the hallmarks of it was, you know, how many offensive players were not big. And that was an extension of a conversation that you and I had had about it just was not something that you valued relative to your peers. And effectively, the market inefficiency that you identified is, you know, if I care about 10 traits and size is one of them, if I can identify the other 9, then I'm willing to sacrifice on size for the benefit of those traits. That is the point of evolution that I wanted to kind of dive into. Because I think, you know, based on some of the things you've said recently, that's, you feel less strongly about that. But before we move off of it, can you just kind of speak to it? Because I do think that a lot of the, like, highest level players that you've been involved in coaching, whether it be Michael Sowers or Teat, did, you know, have that. And in many ways, it's a big function or a big part of not only what makes lacrosse great, but also, you know, a hallmark for a window into how you value what players bring to the table.
Sure. Correction, I never coached Mike Sowers. I've watched him play a bunch, and he's amazing, and I coached against him. But, you know, speaking
to
the...
But you were on the Princeton staff when the conversations about recruiting him
briefly. I mean, I was there. I, you know, went out on the road and watched him play as a high school player and came back and very... I don't know. Nothing revolutionary about that evaluation. Yes, he's awesome. I would want him on my team if I were you, and I would imagine that every coach would probably have that same reaction. It was not a hard evaluation. I'll start with this, because before I even get into the size thing, and it's a fair question, and it's always going to be a criticism if you're not, you know, recruiting one thing or the other, and how people say it. Like, I feel like if you recruit a lot of Dodgers and you don't move the ball well, it becomes a criticism. If you, you know, feel like you want to move the ball more than you want to initiate with the ball in your stick and attack the net as a Dodger, then, you know, you are skewing more in that direction. There's a criticism there. So I get that. It's always a balance in what you're looking for and how you ultimately, you know, build the best team. But again, to your reasoning, like, if you start with the idea that everybody wants the best players in the country and everybody wants the best team, and to build the best team, you don't always need just the best players. You start with needing the best young men, needing the best kids, and you need the guys who are going to fit your team DNA, the way they're going to fit your locker room, the way you're going to fit your style and what you do. And there's, like you mentioned, a whole series of criteria. I think I've always valued decision-making, athleticism, speed, skill. I love size. I just don't know if it always values up over those other things, in certain scenarios. Now, in other scenarios, maybe it's a bigger deal, you know, as maybe you were alluding to, there are times that it becomes more of an emphasis, maybe because there are some size elements that, you know, would be a factor if you either have things or don't. There are times where maybe you have a bigger team and you're like, we're really looking for some more speed in this next class, or, you know, we got guys that can dodge and we got guys that can shoot, but like, we're not seeing open players as well, or, you know, I've got some good cover guys, but I don't know if we're playing off ball very well. We're not sharing defenders very well. We're not communicating very well. Or sometimes you just need leadership. You know, sometimes that's a priority in the recruiting cycle, or, you know, not necessarily every few years. I mean, you need that constantly, but sometimes you just find players that you feel like are a fit for that type of, you know, that element of your team. So, you know, like I said, everybody's going to want to, you know, the huge athletic, super skilled, very smart, you know, do everything, all everything player, you know, with perfect grades and a perfect SAT score and all that. And you like, you're always looking for it, but they very rarely exist and everybody wants them. And so you're at that point just, you know, competing for what, you know, what makes the best fit for your program. And again, I just circle back to this, like you're trying to build the best team, not the best collection of players. And so to me that I think learning in that early on, especially recruiting in the Ivy League, where your pieces kind of have to fit together in a certain way, you recruit a class, not just a list of players. And ultimately you want to be on a team, which is, you know, 4 or 5 years worth of players now. So it's a, you know, not always the same replicated, you know, set of needs year after year. Like I need one of these, one righty, one lefty, one on ball, one off ball, one, you know, you got 5 classes of people to fit those players onto the field. So it doesn't always need to be the same thing, you know, class after class.
I want to close the loop on the line of questioning before pivoting to talking a little bit more about your staff and how you kind of delineate roles. But the size thing was leading toward the question about if you feel like your team needs to be bigger. You talked about circumstances. Is that a reflection of this team in particular? Is it a reflection, or I suppose this team projected a couple years down the road, or is it a reflection of the Big Ten or college lacrosse?
I mean, it's a great question. The answer is going to be a mix of all of those, but you know, the Big Ten is known for having some size in it, and you know, defensively, you can function with you know, some medium size, some large players, and sometimes there are some bigger offensive guys, and you need bigger defensive players. And I think the same thing the other way around. Some of those defenses we play are pretty sizable, you know, and not just the Big Ten, but the ACC as well, which we play a lot of against a lot of them. So, you know, probably more than anything, it's your competition and how you're going to stack up is what's going to drive a lot of the need, you know, because, you know, you're not going to, you know, keep banging your head against the wall if it's not making progress. But, you know, I've, you know, heard this as a reference before, but, you know, you come out of a game and if you went like 2 for 25 on faceoffs, you're probably calling a few faceoff guys that night. You know what I mean? It's just, that's the natural reaction as a coach. It's like, you know, if you hadn't made a save in 3 weeks, like I'm probably on the phone trying to figure out where, you know, where we're getting there. From a recruiting aspect, obviously, like, you know, it's separate than addressing it on the practice field.
I mentioned that I wanted to go to talk about your staff next. So John Cohen, Director of Recruiting, Jameson Kester, the defensive coordinator, have been with you since you arrived at Homewood, and Chase Erlin now transitioning into year 2 as an assistant after graduating and spending his first year as your Director of Ops. How do you describe the way in which responsibilities are distributed with respect to who's meant to watch whom? Does everybody watch everybody in terms of position breakdown? And then also in terms of how you weigh out opinions once everybody comes back to the office and starts sharing them, and then how you distribute contact and you know, just kind of giving guys effectively like responsibilities with respect to, you know, we want you to develop this relationship starting on September 9th.
Coach Cohen is going to assume the largest portion of that responsibility as the recruiting coordinator. And I think that's appropriate. And I think he's earned it. You know, he had a lot of experience before, you know, coming to Baltimore with us, working on the pro level and, you know, as the general manager of the Outlaws, you know, before he came here. And so putting draft boards together, evaluating players, you know, working deals and having conversations, a lot of that experience, it may not always look like it lines up right away, but it's very applicable, especially as the recruiting coordinator now. and tracking that stuff. And, you know, as the coordinator, one of your jobs is obviously to map things out and to, you know, make a plan who goes where and help us out with those things. But it's also to really have the best handle on everything and know where players are, who you're talking to in between the games, in between, you know, the tournaments, you know, making sure your ears are always open for what's out there that I haven't seen yet, or cross-referencing a different database. Like, you got to probably watching more of those highlight reels throughout the summer and checking stats at the end of the spring and stuff like that. And so, you know, starting with that, like, responsible for really, like I said, mapping out the whole thing. But, you know, the first answer is we're all watching everybody. You know, I'm watching every position player just the same as they are. Now, we each have our targeted areas based on what we coach. Chase is watching more offensive guys. Coach K is watching more defensive guys. Cohen watches the faceoff guys, and you know, he skews more defensive, and then I skew more offensive because I work with Chase on that end of the field. But at the end of the day, we're all bringing our notes back. We're all bringing our evaluations back. We're trying to keep you know, consistent tabs on where we are with everybody, so that the second half of the summer we're getting a more targeted approach than the first half of the summer, where we're trying to filter through the mass and see, you know, which teams do we need to see a few more times, which players do we need to see a few more times, starting to talk to coaches and figuring out you know, which players might fit for us, and if we can wait, or if we can get those, you know, look at transcripts before we get to August. You know, because sometimes that's too late. You spend your whole summer watching a guy, you love him, and you realize, like, this isn't going to be a fit for us. You need to have that information early and use that as you're working through. I mean, there's some players that you love all summer, and you're like, that's just not for us. And it's you know, nothing against the kid. It's just there's certain fits for us, and there's certain ones that aren't. And, you know, that also helps you with, I think, a little bit more depth in the evaluations, getting the coach's perspective. You know, I think – there's coaches that you get to know over the summer. There's coaches that you get to know throughout the years that you really rely on as a resource and a sounding board. I mean, I sit next to you sometimes and get some feedback in different areas, but you do that with other college coaches if you have relationships, and you do that with the club and high school coaches, because they're essentially doing the same thing in a different perspective. So they have a handle on it. One of my favorite things to do is asking club and high school coaches who they like that's not on their team. You know, I mean, you ask a coach at the end of the season that they just lost in the playoff game, and they're like, that kid is a big deal. Like, you want to watch him play, and he is a pain in the butt to defend, or he is, you know, he is an impact on the defensive end of the field, whatever it is. Those are sincere evaluations. You know, I've gotten some of the best in my career. I can remember from, like, the first time I heard about a kid was a coach that played against him. And then you just right away, especially from coaches that you work with a lot and trust very well.
So you just answered the question that I was going to pivot to, because I think there are two elements of relationship utilization and development that are interesting. And I think it's a natural place to go once you've established this is how we evaluate and this is how we work together as a staff. And one of them was, how do you, because I think that, you know, relative to a lot of your peers, I feel like I hear you say that you rely on your network. And I think that, you know, by virtue of, you know, the Gettysburg network, the Pro Lacrosse network, and then probably mostly in terms of at least what it sounds like, you know, the Rochester and upstate New York more broadly network, like, it's like, yeah, you can get a lot of information from people that you have, you know, 20 or 30 years of familiarity with. The second side of the relationship component of it is meeting these kids and their families. How do you describe how you either, I don't want to lead the jury. How do you describe the process? What are the, you know, things that happen once you can pick up the phone at whatever time it is, 7 a.m. I guess now, on September 9th, and then, you know, the intervening month or so?
Sure. So I want to precede that a little bit with I think the tie-in from what you were just referencing, like the network is, it's more than just the people that you know. It's the people that you have worked with through this process, you add into the network. And so some of the best resources are the coaches from programs that you've recruited in the past. And maybe it's not even from where you've gotten your best players or where you've gotten a lot of players. Maybe it's just one kid you got 10 years ago, but you just stay in touch with that guy. I mean, there's coaches I've talked to where I cycle through that conversation every year. And, you know, 4 out of 5 years, it's like, nah, I don't think I have anything for you, but you know who is good, or you know who you're going to like, or, you know, in 2 years, I might have a kid the right way that, you know, that lines up with what you're looking for, things like that. Because again, it's more, in my opinion, it's more than the evaluation on what they look like as a player. It's, you know, who are these young men that we're working with? You know, it's my, my favorite part about connecting with the high school coaches. Like a lot of, you know, you're talking about, and maybe this is aging me a little bit, but like the amount of public high school coaches who, you know, maybe not be full-time coaches at that school, or they're teachers, or, you know, they have other jobs, they show up, but like they're around there a lot. They know those kids well, they know the families, they know the background, they know brothers and family members and things like that. And so they have a better handle on who this young man is. And, you know, one of those elements that, you know, maybe wasn't on that list that you originally mentioned that I put, you know, so much emphasis on is like, is this kid going to continue to trend in the right direction? Like, is this a unique individual that no matter what the circumstances are, no matter where he goes, you know, starting lineup or not, wherever he is, he's going to make a positive impact on the team. He is going to continue to get better because of his work rate, because of his, you know, character. You know, are these high quality young men that will make a lasting impact on this program, even if they don't score a goal for us, even if they don't start a game? And I think those are hard things to recruit, just taking notes on the sideline, and they can be hard to extrapolate from the conversations you have. But I think finding ways to work through those conversations and trust, you know, certain things that you hear a certain way, and really materialize. And I think that's in my opinion, one of the biggest pieces of the evaluation process that just gets assumed. Because, you know, because the coach says he's a great kid, or because the coach, you know, because he's a captain, or because he, you know, is a great player. I mean, you have to really dig through the evaluations. But moreover, I mean, it comes from getting to know the kid and the depth of it. And there is that next step, I think, what you were just mentioning, like once you start that conversation with the recruit, with the family, and how you work through it. And I don't know, that could probably go in a million different directions. So I don't know exactly what what you'd want to go into specifically.
Yeah, Paul, I want to pause and kind of ask a specific follow-up to what you just mentioned, because I was remiss in not asking it in the first place. How is it distinct, specifically when you think about Canada, where it's not just about network? You know, obviously there's also a core distinction there, the difference between Canadians who go to prep school in the U.S. and play field lacrosse versus the ones who don't. You know, pretty much it's very rare now that you get a box only player coming out of Canada. But even still, you know, there's kind of one like kind of pathway toward recruiting and developing a relationship with a Canadian who goes to Lawrenceville or Culver or Deerfield or whatever, relative to, you know, somebody who doesn't. Even a distinction is somebody who goes to St. Moise or the Hill Academy versus, you know, somebody that goes to a school that doesn't have, you know, a traditional pipeline to play in college. How, I know you have a robust network in Canada. How do you describe the way that manifests?
It's going to sound ridiculous, but it's very similar, but very different in a lot of ways. I mean, you're still trusting evaluations. You're still, you know, asking for references and taking notes, but you may be watching different versions of lacrosse. You may be watching less club lacrosse. You may be watching, box only. You may be watching different versions of highlight clips, going to watch kids against teams that you don't recruit against normally. I mean, recruiting in Canada is far from new and revolutionary. I mean, I don't claim to have any sort of you know, angle on anything when it comes to that. But I do have some good relationships and grew up very close to there, and so I've leaned on those heavily. There's also a pretty well formed system of youth lacrosse up there. It's all indoor, but it is a really great way of evaluating how kids stack up against their peers. It's not a great way of saying this kid would fit into my offense this way, or this has the right, you know, he has the right kind of moves to execute this dodge in that situation. Like you have to go see those things. You can watch some box players make really high skill plays and be a really high level decision. You can watch them play really tough lacrosse and be relentless, and you can get, you know, great character evaluations from coaches and stuff like that. I think that's where you need some depth of understanding that game and how it translates, or realistically how your version, you know, can use those players to apply to it. But you know, that the one of the biggest factors, I think, in recruiting north of the border is that, you know, the kids have all been playing against the same age group, age-based essentially eligibility, since forever. So you can talk to a long list of folks up there who could probably give you a pretty clear distinction between number one and number 10 in the class and what that order is. And it's probably pretty consistent across those folks. Now, that doesn't mean it's going to translate, you know, that the number one player is going to be that much better than the number 10 player field lacrosse. But when it comes to, you know, indoor lacrosse or, you know, those other set of criteria, you're just saying skills, athleticism, you know, awareness on the floor, stuff like that. They play so much in a pretty similar setup that there can be a pretty clear distinction. You know what I mean? Like, it's been reliable over the years with things like that. And that helps because there are some players that maybe who aren't playing in the States during the season or don't come down to play a lot of club that you don't get a ton of evaluations. And so getting comparable references, I think, can be a big factor.
No doubt. So you brought it up earlier, and I think it's a nice segue into talking about how the changes in college sports broadly are affecting you with respect to the fifth year. Mm-hmm. But before we get to that, I want to get to your thoughts on Johns Hopkins as the most unique men's lacrosse program. You're a Division III athletic department with Division I men's and women's lacrosse playing in the Big Ten. Mm-hmm. There is that in and of itself, in my opinion is... Nothing can be more unique than that. How do you describe what it means for how you have to go about doing your job?
Unique is a pretty good way of saying it, but there's a lot of layers on top of what you just said. It's the top 10 academic institution. This is the most successful program in the history of our sport by virtually every measure, from wins to championships to All-Americans, things like that. So there's a lot of layers to what you were just talking about, I'll probably answer it. I'll start answering it by a phrase that I use in virtually every recruiting experience that I go through when kids sit down in the office, when I talk to them on the phone, and basically every kid on my team has heard this a number of times over. But Johns Hopkins is not for everybody. I don't assume that everybody would think it is, but I think there's probably a lot of places out there that you would assume everybody would want to be on that team. And I don't think that about us. And I don't think that's a bad thing. I use that as part of the recruiting pitch, but it's also, it's part of the angle that that builds this team a certain way. It's a part of the makeup of what makes this place so special and so amazing, is that you need individuals that understand what this is. You know, they aren't going to all know the history of everything that's ever happened here, and you can't teach them all that in the recruiting process. You know, that's part of your experience when you get on campus, but they need to understand what separates us out in a lot of ways, and also they need to understand a little bit more about the depth of, you know, what makes us highly competitive and why this place is in the Big Ten and why this is still, you know, one of the best programs year after year on the lacrosse field. And I think there's a lot of assumptions about a lot of things because people don't see Johns Hopkins on TV or playing football or in a lot of other scenarios the same way that they see some of the other schools that we recruit against. You can assume when you look at, you know, maybe an Ivy League school, you have some pretty good ideas of the way things have operated there for a long time in every sport, because it's not a lot has changed over the last couple hundred years with those. Johns Hopkins, you know, it's a, like I said, world-class university. It's a high-level athletic department. They are, you know, in the top two or three in Director's Cup points in Division III athletics, won the cup a couple of years ago or two couple of years in a row. But again, it's not as visible as some other programs. So the lacrosse program here kind of carries a lot of that responsibility.
So this is going to be the question that you're going to like the least that I've asked so far. I say all the time that Inside Lacrosse's rankings don't matter, in the sense that when they diverge from, they're meant to be a reflection of the consensus. And so in the instances in which the rankings diverge from a coach's opinion, of course, it's not going to influence the decision that he makes for the purposes of the rankings. However, the rankings come out before athletes are able to be contacted by college lacrosse coaches. informed by conversations that we have with your peers about how they are going to value and for like what the level of demand is going to be for a certain player. And so the class rankings represent the commitments that you get by virtue of those player rankings, which are a reflection of how in demand the players are going to be. So when you have good class rankings, what it means is that a lot of your peers wanted those players as well. And the 25s were better than the previous classes. The 26s were better as far as our class rankings are concerned. The 26s were better than the 25s, and the 27s were better than the 26s. What do you attribute that growing success to?
In reference to the inside lacrosse rankings and that...
No. Well, fine. Let me ask it this way. Do you think that your success in recruiting has grown over the course of the last 4 years successively?
I would say it's evolved, and there's some I think development that can be attributed to success on the field. There can be some attributed to the branding of this coaching staff and the version of this program that we're currently operating, and sometimes that comes with the exposure of the success on the field, the players that you're getting in those processes. Maybe it's getting a handle on the ins and the outs of university. You know, you mentioned Coach Cohen and Kester. We got here the same time, and that was May of 2020. So, you know, having the university basically closed for almost the first year we were here, having no fall ball, high expectations in an environment where we were dealing with added challenges. I don't know if there was very many coaches that changed jobs that summer. Really, there's some evolution that we're referring to that maybe comes with experience and stability where we're at and getting a handle on the development, not just in singular phases, but like as you said, over the course of time, 6-7 years, and starting to watch these things stack up, like the type of players that we're looking for and how we get there. And I think in a specific fashion, the development of your team identity, your team culture, being such a significant piece that you can that helps attract the players that you're looking for, and that may take some time to establish before you really are able to expose it to the recruits the way you want to. And I think that takes some development, takes some depth, and we've had some amazing guys to coach and work with over the years here, and I think some of them would speak openly about that the same way. Like there was some ups and downs and some getting to know each other and some struggles, not just on the field, but like as we're working through what we want to prioritize and how we want to establish those things. And so I think that has taken some time, but having Coach Cohen as the recruiting coordinator is the most important piece in the process, having been here for 6 years. We've had some good coaches that have been here in the last few years, but having that stability, I think, is a big part of the recruiting process.
I kind of indirectly referenced this earlier with respect to the way in which Hopkins is uniquely situated within the changing landscape of college athletics. I mean, it's been on my to-do list for almost a month at this point, and I haven't finished it because it's just so hard to wrap my arms around the idea of high school players in the class of 22 getting a fifth year of eligibility. And every time I feel like I have written something, a new injunction comes out or a stay to an injunction is instituted. So the point I'm getting at is I'm not going to ask you about that specifically because I don't think that you would have a good answer, because I don't think anybody specifically in lacrosse, where, at the very least, we have the benefit of being a spring sport, whereas football and basketball are dealing with this right now. Okay. But it is an entry point into, so the ability to stack financial and merit-based aid, the institution of NIL, the institution of a 48-person roster limit for schools that have opted in, the elimination of a 12.6 scholarship limit, and a fifth year of eligibility. I don't even know how to ask a question about that, so let me just say your thoughts.
That's, yeah, I guess that's an open-ended from there. I mean, it's a tidal wave of information and change, and it seems to have spaced out almost yearly. You know, as soon as you get a handle on what the new rules are, it seems like another one's changing. And you opened this with the uncertainty of the 22 class eligibility wise. And somebody asked me this the other day, like, why isn't there more information on this inside lacrosse? I'm like, probably because you can't finish an article before the rule that the announcement comes out that there's another change to it. And I would imagine that, like, at this point, it's not going to serve you any purpose to post something that's going to be wrong tomorrow. So the only real certainty right now is that we don't know exactly, how long the rules are going to stay static and if anything big is going to change in the near future. I mean, we got to operate as if this is our current environment, but make sure that we maintain some agility to make changes if they come up. And some of those things are presenting new challenges that we don't know about until they get here. You're trying to see into the future and whatnot, and all while you're building the best team currently, you're keeping track of how you maintain the trajectory and the success going forward. So I don't even know, since there wasn't technically a question, what the answer is. I'm just going to talk around those things for a few minutes and try and not answer anything specifically. But yeah, it's a lot. It's kind of a wild world. College athletics in general is just changing more right now in like 20 minutes than it's changed in 20 years. But I also think that it's very exciting times because we are moving into space where we can, create more opportunity for the athletes. Some of them can earn income in ways that they couldn't before, and we're not even in the comparison to football and basketball, where some of them are making more money to stay in college than play in pro. And we can keep hiding it under this veil of amateurism, but it's just definitely different now. But we are taking advantage of every opportunity that we see right now and trying to be competitive as we can, this year and moving forward. But it's an interesting landscape. I don't know if I would say unstable, but consistently changing. If we're based on a track record the last 5-6 years, it's going to keep changing.
Okay. Well said. But I will ask a direct question. However, I'm going to frame it, I think, pretty easily for you, because I think that the public has a broad misconception and a significant misconception in terms of what matters most when it comes to high school recruits making decisions about where they want to play college lacrosse. So I think the public perception is that NIL matters most. Scholarships matter second most. And I don't even think that they think about the idea of stacking aid. Because my contention is that NIL dollars, especially in the last year after the Deloitte Clearinghouse has been created, have shrunk. It's not to say that there are no NIL opportunities. It is to say that the influence of collectives in terms of being able to actually put cash in the pocket of athletes has diminished over the last year, which is to say that the advantage kind of falls to the largest athletic departments that have infrastructure across all their sports, because at least there's market-based value going to them, whereas donor-led collectives now struggle a little bit more to find that market-based value because it requires a lot of time and attention in order to actually get it over the finish line. So my contention is that NIL matters least. The scholarship allotments matter. It's kind of a tie, because ultimately, like, they affect the cost of attendance. That's what matters most. That's what families are making decisions on. And the notion that we had Joe Bresci on about a month ago and talked about the state of North Carolina's rules that reclassified athletes for in-state tuition without changing the budget of the scholarship allotment. And that got close to effectively tripling North Carolina's scholarship amount. Mm-hmm. Got them, let's call it 35, right? You accept them. I don't think that there's really anybody that's over 20, meaningfully over 20, meaning that, like, the majority are in that 12.6 to 20 range. But the financial aid elements that have emerged over the last, this predates COVID and predates the transfer portal, but still not by much, have mattered more. Do you agree?
Do I agree? Probably, but it also depends on who you're asking. I mean, if you're asking me, I think, yeah, it's a pretty significant factor, but, you know, there's other programs that might not see it that same way. I don't know. I wouldn't be able to speak for anybody outside, you know, of my office right now. You know, even with all the rule changes that you just referenced, like one of the biggest factors might also now be roster limits. Like there's a lot of these factors that are coming in, and they're kind of, like we said, they're coming in, you know, successive order of like, there's a change, then there's another one, then you add this, and then there's that element. And so there's a lot of pieces that have, you know, reshaped and shaken this thing up. And there is definitely a misconception of, you know, sponsorship dollars and NIL money and whatnot. And that's because the basketball and football money is what's dominating the airwaves. And usually the only ones you hear about on lacrosse are the, you know, really unique ones or something like that. And so that ends up being perception. And, you know, I have this conversation when we do prospect camps here, I do, you know, like a recruiting session for parents and, you know, just pull them into the, you know, the film room or conference room or something like that, get them away from the, you know, the kids and just ask questions. We will talk openly. I can't tell you specifically about us, but I will help you understand the landscape and really how to help your kid through this process. Cause unless you've got multiple older children, most of the time your first question is what the heck is going on. And so, you know, working through that process, but essentially what I tell them is that like you're taking most of your information for your kid because you guys probably don't know that much, like I said, unless you've been through it before. And mostly what your kid is getting is information off the internet. And so most of their impressions are coming from a very small percentage of the class. And these are like, I cite statistics that, you know, you and I were talking about years ago, is that like the, you know, the percentage of kids that end up being Division I lacrosse players or early recruit Division I lacrosse players, you're talking about like 1-3% of the entire population of the class that ends up being in a situation to commit to a school or being offered, you know, high dollars or even sponsorship dollars that make news, that make, you know, into the media. And that's what people use as a lot of their references. And those are so unrealistic for the other, let's say 90%+ of the class easily. And so it's easy and understandable for there to be misconception. And you know, but you also, as much as you want to get what you want to, you know, win the race, whatever it is, you also want to make sure that this is a fair experience and environment for everybody. So educating the parents and educating the families is part of your job. You want to make sure they understand the landscape. Like, you know, I think there's different tactics for recruiting and everybody can have their own. And I feel like letting folks make an informed and well thought out decision is crucial in that process, especially with, you know, the age of the kids we're talking about and maybe the volatility of the landscape. Like, put them in a situation to have a good sense of what's going on, because the last thing you want is for it to be a wrong decision for you or for them. But even if it feels like it's the right decision for you and it's the wrong for them, it might not always be a very good fit. And that's when you end up with, you know, I don't know, challenges on your roster or changes on your roster in the transfer portal. And it's a lot easier now than it used to be to transfer. So it's just more likely that those things happen. And that might be one of the other like complementary effects that you're referring to, is like with all these things, like it's just likely that with roster limits and scholarships and things changing, like you saw a massive influx in the major sports that you see, football and basketball and things like that, with transfers, that you're just going to start seeing more of it. And it's unfortunate. Nobody, you know, was excited about that version of it, but see, I guess it's just it's the price you get with some of these new, I don't know, changes.
Last one, cause we're running out of time. 5-5, the additional year, it certainly created a lot of fear in terms of smaller class sizes for players in the class of 28. It's interesting because, you know, it also affects the 27s. But, you know, obviously that was a decision that was made after, you know, a lot of those guys had committed. How are you thinking about it? How is your staff thinking about it with respect to your own roster, the prospect of taking in any fifth-year transfers, and what it means for how you want to structure the 28 class in terms of size and when you want to take their commitments?
Any question about the age-based eligibility and 5-for-5, I don't think it's a relevant conversation unless you couple it with the roster limits. Because if there was no roster limit a few years ago, if there's no roster limit changed, and we're having a 5-and-5 conversation, all it's going to do is force coaches to adjust their plan for how many guys they would take to get to the, you know, end result of a roster number. But if you couple that with a roster limit, now it's an immovable limit that you have to fit inside of, and getting inside of that limit got increasingly more challenging when you gave everybody additional eligibility, and then there's some personal factors to it. So in some ways I think it's great because it gives certain guys more time on campus that you weren't anticipating before, and you can you know build in a little bit longer with them and have more time. It creates challenges in uncertainty and probably what you're referring to, and what I think is the general impression out there, is that you're going to recruit smaller classes because of that. And if you know you just look at 48 divided by 4, it's different than divided by 5, and it's not a massive number, but if you multiply that out over all the teams, it's a pretty big shift in the class. And so we're looking at it as competitively as we can, and also trying to manage the environment on campus and how we handle that. You know, we can continue to recruit 12 kids a year. You're going to inevitably have to, you know, remove guys or cut guys from your roster, which is not a place that I think any coach enjoys being. Now, maybe there's some people that would enjoy that because they could get a more competitive environment to have 80 people trying out every year. Just in my opinion, that's not the right fit for everybody. And it's not the right way to do it for a lot of programs. So, you know, just it presents I think a like situation for everybody to evaluate their own way and how they do it. I do think the ease of not having to deal with waivers and approvals and, you know, different reasons. And now guys are in 6 and 7 years. And it's just like, in that regard, if we could be done with that, that would be great. I don't know if this is the best way to do it, but I'm not on that committee.
That's a great note to end on. Pete Milliman, ability to solve all the world's problems. Really appreciate your time. Thanks so much for the insight, and look forward to talking to you again soon.
You got it. Thanks.
Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.